Hello. It is Thursday, July 25th. I'm Lodi Evola, and I'll be reading to you from the front pages of the Hartford Courant and the New York Times. We'll begin, as we always do, with a description of the photographs on both newspapers, several on the Times, the top photograph, about a 5x7, and it will be our top story. It shows Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday speaking before Congress. He is at the podium, at the microphone. His left hand is clenched, about to bang down, it appears, on the podium behind him, arrayed behind him too, and I won't identify them all. There are two men standing, clapping, two men sitting and watching Netanyahu speak, and below them all, four women, two facing in from the right, two facing in from the left, listening to him speak. And as I said, that will be our top story today. Another photograph, about a 2x2, shows Vice President Kamala Harris striding, and that is the word to use. She is focused, dressed in a light suit, heels, heading toward a car. We will have a story about her today. And another photograph, about a 4x4, shows the Marching 100 Band from St. Augustine High School in New Orleans, and they are facing the Eiffel Tower, spiring into a bright blue sky. This, of course, will be with our Olympics story today, and there are illuminated Olympic rings on the Eiffel Tower. The band is dressed, by the way, in blue and gold helmets. And then another photograph, probably another 2x2, shows a house in Washington which has had visitors from John F. Kennedy to Princess Diana visiting, was lived in by Catherine Graham for years and years. And that house has been left vacant. And unfortunately, we won't have time for that story today. And then another one, about a 3x6, I would say, in Venezuela. So it's a photograph of Maria Corina Machado in Venezuela. She's standing on top of a car, waving to a crowd which is gathered behind her, around her, actually. Flags waving, hands clapping, cell phones taking photographs. She is the opposition leader in Venezuela. Her movement has won wide support. And again, unfortunately, we will not have time for that story today. And then on the Hartford Courant, the top two photographs of the same place, Castle Craig in Meriden. It is experiencing low cloud cover, which is a phenomenon that people go to see there, and it shows a turret going up into the sky, a huge tree nearby, and two young women trotting up to it. And then another photograph with a smaller photograph with a close-up of the tower, and it looks to be blanketed in fog. And then the last photograph of Linda Kosuda Baghazi, and we will have that story. She's a woman accused of, or has been convicted of, killing her husband in Connecticut. And with that, we will go to our first story today. Deriding critics, Netanyahu backs conduct of war. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel on Wednesday turned and addressed Congress into a full-throated defense of Israel's military campaign in Gaza. He cast it as a battle for the survival of the Jewish state, while making almost no mention of the tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians killed in its drive to to destroy Hamas. The address laid bare deep divisions in Washington over the nine-month war, whose toll on civilians has outraged many Democrats and drawn international condemnation. Dozens of Democrats did not show up, with some openly boycotting the speech. Vice President Kamala Harris, the party's presumptive presidential nominee, who was campaigning in the Midwest, declined to preside in her capacity as president of the Senate alongside Speaker Mike Johnson, a break with tradition. Outside the Capitol, pepper spray filled the air as police officers tried to push back thousands of protesters who had gathered to jeer Mr. Netanyahu. Demonstrators held signs calling him a war criminal, burned an effigy of him and an American flag, and vandalized statues with anti-Israel slogans, including "Hamas is coming." In a speech in which he condemned critics of the war as dupes aligning themselves with the world's most dangerous actors or apologists for terrorists, Mr. Netanyahu portrayed the conflict as a proxy fight with Iran that must be won at all costs to protect both Israel and the United States. When we fight Iran, we are fighting the most radical and murderous enemy of the United States, he said. We're not only protecting ourselves, we're protecting you, he added, emphasizing the alliance that has existed since Israel's creation. He said nothing about the tensions in the relationship that have flared as Israel has used American weapons in attacks that have led, by the count of Gazan authorities, to 39,000. And deaths. The fact of Mr. Netanyahu's speech was almost as notable as anything he said. In the face of increasing international censure and dissent, both in Israel and in the United States, Mr. Netanyahu was seeking to use Congress to lift his sagging political fortunes. Leaders in both parties obliged with a bipartisan invitation to receive him. But in the House chamber, as he spoke, there was clear evidence of how the long-standing bipartisan consensus to back Israel has eroded in Congress since the offensive in Gaza that followed the October 7 attack that killed roughly 1,200 Israelis. The substantial number of Democratic no-shows included two top senators and Representative Nancy Pelosi, the former speaker, who later called the speech by far the worst presentation of any foreign dignitary invited and honored with the privilege of addressing Congress in the United States. 48-hour spurt hoisted Harris to top of party. Late on Sunday morning, Vice President Kamala Harris summoned a small clutch of her closest advisors and allies to the Naval Observatory, where she lives and works, with little notice and even less information. President Biden had informed Ms. Harris earlier that morning that he was withdrawing from the race. The vice president had assembled her team so that the exact moment Mr. Biden formally quit at 1:46 p.m., 1 minute after the president had informed his own senior staff, they were ready to go. Time was of the essence. A sprawling call list of the most important Democrats to reach had been prepared in advance, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. The vice president, in sneakers and a sweatshirt, began methodically dialing Democratic power brokers. "I wasn't going to let this day go by without you hearing from me," Ms. Harris had said over and over as day turned to night, according to five people who received her calls or were briefed on them. She phoned past Democratic presidents, many of her potential rivals, including Governors Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, J.B. Pritzker of Illinois, and Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania, the Democratic conventional leaders, Senator Bernie Sanders, the heads of the various influential caucuses, and other top Democrats, a person with direct knowledge of the call list said. The blitz demonstrated exactly the kind of vigor and energy that Mr. Biden had lacked in recent weeks. Mr. Biden had reportedly made 20 calls to congressional Democrats in the first 10 or so days after the debate, while his candidacy hung in the balance. Ms. Harris made 100 calls in 10 hours. At the same time that Ms. Harris was dialing, a new whip operation was set up to wrangle delegates who will ultimately select the nominee, integrating her team and the pre-existing Biden-Harris campaign's delegate operation. Within 48 hours, Ms. Harris had functionally cleared the Democratic field of every serious rival, clinched the support of more delegates than needed to secure the party nomination, raised more than $100 million, and delivered a crisper message against former President Donald J. Trump than Mr. Biden had mustered in months. In City of Lights, Shadows, Monuments to Sports. There is a glorious folly to the Paris Olympics, the first in the city since 1924, as if France, in its perennial revolutionary ardor, took a century to ponder something unimaginable, the transformation of a great city into a stadium. The heart of Paris has fallen silent in preparation for the opening ceremony on Friday, when a flotilla will usher thousands of athletes down the Seine under the low-slung bridges where lovers like to linger. Not since the COVID-19 pandemic has the city been so still or so constrained. From the Pont d'Austerlitz in the east to the Pont Marabout in the west, roads are closed, newly built stands for spectators line the riverbanks, fences enclose sidewalks, and residents need police-issued QR codes to reach their homes. The golden cherubs, nymphs, and winged horses of the Pont Alexandre III gaze out on metal bleachers and posses of police. The Olympic project is almost unthinkable in its audacity and a major security headache. But then the Eiffel Tower would never have risen above Paris in 1889 if the many naysayers had prevailed. As it went up for the Paris World Fair, Guy de Maupassant called the tower a giant, hideous skeleton, that's in quotes, that had driven him out of Paris. Now, between its first and second floors, five giant Olympic rings in blue, yellow, black, green, and red adorn the tower. They glow at night over the Champ de Mars Park, where the beach volleyball competition will be held. Nearby flows the Seine, beautified at a cost of about $1.5 billion, and clean enough, it is said, for several Olympic events, including two 10-kilometer swims and the triathlon. Swimming in the Seine was banned 101 years ago. All things come to an end. These games, at a cost of about $4.75 billion, were conceived to be transformative in a lasting, environmentally conscious way. We wanted a dash of revolution, something the French would look back at with pride, Tony Estanguet, the head of the Paris Olympic Committee, said. And another Olympic story, actually. The International Olympic Committee awarded the 2034 Winter Games to Salt Lake City on Wednesday, only after a last-minute demand that the agreement shield global sports authorities from U.S. investigations into doping by Chinese athletes. Organizers of Salt Lake City's bid and Governor Spencer J. Cox of Utah agreed to the changes sought by the IOC. The unexpected twist came amid an escalating dispute between the Global Anti-Doping Agency and its American counterpart, and at a time when the Justice Department and Congress are looking into why Chinese swimmers who tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs 3 years ago were not subject to penalties from the World Anti-Doping Agency. Mr. Cox told IOC members before Wednesday's vote awarding the 2034 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games to Salt Lake City that he would work with the levers of power, including in Congress, to alleviate your concerns. The announcement brought fully into the open a festering clash within the sports world over reports of Chinese doping, the adequacy of the response, and aggressive efforts by the United States to combat it. Critics of the IOC and the anti-doping agency, known as WADA, WADA, said they saw the developments as a blatant effort to cover up both a pattern of suspicious activity in the Chinese swimming program and the unwillingness of WADA to confront it. It is shocking to see the IOC itself stooping to threats in an apparent effort to silence those seeking answers to what are now known as facts, said Travis Tygart, the chief executive, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, which has been in an increasingly open battle with WADA over policing the use of banned substances. It seems more apparent than ever that WADA violated the rules and needs accountability and reform to truly be the global watchdog that clean athletes need, Mr. Tygart said in a statement. And our last story before our weather break, Mediterranean drought leads to fears of water wars. As tourists savored icy granitas under hibiscus trees and swam in the cool Mediterranean Sea, in the farmlands of southern Sicily, among hillsides so scorched they resembled desert dunes, a farmer watched recently as his cows headed to the slaughterhouse. After months of drought, he didn't have any water or food to give them. "It's devastating," said the farmer, Lorenzo Arachi Sereri, as tears fell on his tanned face, lined by 40 years of labor pasturing cows. "I have never seen something like this." Parts of southern Italy and other Mediterranean regions, including Greece and southeastern Spain, are experiencing one of their worst droughts in decades. It is particularly devastating, experts say, because the lack of rainfall has been made worse by the higher temperatures caused by climate change. Artificial basins where animals used to drink offer little but cracked earth. Wheat ears are small and hollow. Pergusa Lake in central Sicily, part of a natural reserve, resembles a pale, dry crater. But for many of these regions, the summer is also peak season for tourism, a key economic lifeline that the authorities fear is being threatened by news of water scarcity and that they are trying to protect. "We are forced to sacrifice the damage to agriculture, but we have to try not to damage tourism because it would be even worse," said Salvatore Cucina, the head of Sicily's civil protection. He added that agriculture still accounts for the vast majority of water use, with the general population using just a fraction of it, even when it includes millions of tourists during the summer. The authorities said they prioritized providing water to hospitals, to businesses that produce key assets like oxygen, and to vulnerable segments of the population, but also to hotels. "The tourists don't notice the drought," Elvira Amata, Sicily's top tourism official, promised. Outside five-star resorts in the arid south of the island, the signs were everywhere. In Agrigento, which overlooks a valley holding the ruins of several Greek temples, the authorities are rationing water. Some homes on the outskirts have not received any in weeks. Water scarcity has meant that a small number of small bed and breakfasts also had to pull some rooms from the market or redirect customers to other hotels, said Francesco Piccarella, the head of Italy's main hotels association in Agrigento.